From theheart.org radio, you are listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein.
Well, this is Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein for another edition of Click and Rub, also known as Card Talk. And this segment is going to be dedicated to presidents and vice presidents' recent note with coronary disease, namely former President Bill Clinton and former Vice President Dick Cheney. So, Paul, let me turn over to you to kind of frame the Bill Clinton thing. This has attracted enormous attention around the world, but also on theheart.org.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting to see everyone get so interested in it. In fact, if you look at theheart.org, it's fascinating because there's a whole comment section after the story, and there are 68 posts. The most recent is yesterday. Most of them talking about secondary prevention is actually quite an interesting discussion. But I read it all through, and as far as I can tell, the upshot is that if only President Clinton had been drinking pomegranate juice, he wouldn't have needed another stent.
Well, you know, it's actually amazing. That may be one of the records, maybe not the most, but close to the most comments ever posted, and it's gotten enormous traffic. But it takes us back to the whole framing the coronary disease story with Bill Clinton. And it's interesting because I'll never forget, you know, it was back in Labor Day weekend, 2004, and I had a chance to see the angios. And, you know, I was wondering why he didn't get stented back then. He had an LAD diag bifurcation lesion that wasn't all that, you know, crazy. He had a
Wait, you saw the angiograms?
Yeah, sure.
So you're going to tell us what, because I don't think anyone's really disclosed the angiograms.
Yeah, no, I was possibly going to be involved.
So tell us the anatomy if you're able to.
There were two lesions in the right coronary artery. They were tandem lesions, eminently approachable. A cirque that was also very attractive. And then the only thing that looked like it might be a little bit more than typical, this is now 6 years ago, 2004, was LAD bifurcation and the diagonal. But, you know, with five stents, he could have had a way to bypass the bypass.
Yeah, and he had unstable angina, I think, so he wouldn't really be a courage candidate, right? So we don't have to have that whole discussion, I don't think, right? He needed vascular
Right. Vascularization
from that.
Yeah,
point.
He had, I guess, rest discomfort when he initially presented, and they were worried about him possibly teetering on a non-Q wave infarction. I don't think he had one. I don't think he ever actually had any myocardial damage. But, as you know, I guess the surgery went okay after they had to wait a few days for clopidogrel to wear off. But then he had to go back for another surgery for decortication.
Well, that's always the problem. You know, just to speak generally, I didn't really know his anatomy. I never saw his films. But, you know, it sounds like he had a intermediate syntax score kind of case. We have two-year data. Now the mortality is going to be equivalent both procedures. But, of course, the problem with surgery is there's a lot of other complications that don't really show up in the death, MI, stroke, and revascularization endpoint, like cortication and need for pacemakers and things like that that don't show up. But the good news, though, is this was at Columbia where they do great surgery. Craig Smith's really terrific. And, you know, I don't know what kind of bypasses they did, but knowing Craig, he would have gotten hopefully more than just, you know, a Lima if he could, because Craig does a lot of multi-arterial grafts, and that's good.
Well, but what happened, because that was around September of 2004, mm-hmm. and here we are, you know, we're well short of 6 years, five and a half, whatever,
yeah.
years, not even a half, so five some years, and he's had new lesions and had to get two stents. So what went wrong here?
Well, this is not unusual. It's actually very common for a post-CABG patient.
Well, I don't know. Most patients after surgery are good, average 8 to 10 years.
Well, I think the Lima is good probably forever in 95% of the patients, but the other grafts tend to, you know, there's an attrition, and that's well known, even Rimas and radials. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I'm
a vein graft. Do we know if this was a vein graft intervention?
We don't know. We were not told that, though.
No, we don't know anything.
Actually, we were told that the stents are in his native circumflex. That we were told, two stents in his native circumflex.
Because I thought I read somewhere that his vein graft had closed. And so they went and used a native
vessel. That wouldn't be unusual if a vein graft or even an arterial graft that wasn't a Lima closed. That's what typically happens. And actually, the good thing was that he had whatever closed, while it was open, it didn't accelerate the disease of his native vessel. So he was amenable to a stent procedure. Because all too often, if a vein graft is used, the vein grafts are such large caliber that they compete vigorously with the native flow. And basically, the native vessel shrivels up because of the competing flow from a vein graft. And then, you know, 5 to 10 years later, when the vein graft gets diseased and closes, now your underlying native vessel's also closed, and those patients really don't have an option. That's one of my big criticisms of randomized trials and the way you interpret the data, because the big difference, of course, is in revascularization. The need for repeat revascularization is always higher in the stent arm compared to the bypass arm. But, of course, a lot of the bypass patients who may have recurrence of angina and get cast, they just turn out they're not candidates for revascularization. It's not that they don't need it, but they have an open lima and they have a closed, maybe it's a right coronary and the right graft is closed and you can't really do it.
Well, I have to disagree with you on the thought that this is typical. I mean, all the patients that I've looked after bypass surgery, I believe unusually early, particularly if there were multiple artery grafts.
I think there's data on that. You know, there's data on that about, you know, a good half of the vein grafts by the time 7 years come along have more than a 50% narrowing.
Some of that data are old. That is, you know, the only time when they actually did angiograms of vein grafts was in the pre-statin, pre, you know, antiplatelet, pre-everything era.
The PROTECT IV trial was a randomized trial over 1,000 patients. They had 80% angiographic follow-up at 1 year, and the vein graft attrition was enormous.
Well, but
it
wasn't 50%.
I think it was 40% in 1 year.
Really?
Yeah. It's really remarkable. And
who did those operations?
Well, a lot of people did it. And one of the good things about Clinton surgery was that likely, since Craig did it, wasn't just veins. And I think that's a positive way to do surgery. In fact, celebrities are kind of helpful to us because you can use them and discuss procedures with your patients and options. When we talk about how patients will do after stenting, you can point to, for example, Cheney, who had stents, and the stents restenosed, and he had to have a second procedure. He also had bypass surgery, too. And fallible as these procedures are, Cheney's probably kept alive by them. I mean, he had bypass surgery. He is a defibrillator. He's had two stent procedures.
We'll get to him in a second.
Yeah.
But anyway, just to wrap up here, so we have a little bit of different perspective, but then, you know, supposedly he was really into risk factor modification. I don't know about the pomegranate juice, but, I mean, I heard Alan Schwartz's comments as an interview where he's really been taking care of himself, and unfortunately this occurred. And, you know, I'm sure
let me give you another perspective on it, okay, Eric?
Yeah.
Actually, this might just be a good thing for him, because what I'm promoting these days is hybrid procedures. And, you know, as you know, at Scripps, we're doing robotic lima takedowns, and then with a small incision in the fourth intercostal space, attaching the lima to the LAD. And then in the right patients, we're doing this, following it by stents instead of vein grafts. In radial conduits, that may not be so great. So you could argue that really what he had, what President Clinton had, was sort of a hybrid now. He had a lima to the LAD. I'm sure he's got that. I don't know the anatomy, but I'm sure that's what was done. It had to be. And
I would hope
something,
so.
And one of the grafts, probably to his circumflex, because we heard that his circumflex had two stents, isn't open. But at least he was able to get that stent. And so now he's got two stents and a circumflex, and he's got a lima and an LAD. Now he's in good shape. I kind of don't care what happens to the right coronary now, because, you know, patients usually can do pretty well no matter what happens to it. So you could look at it as a failure, but you can also look at it in a positive way and say, you know, he's actually probably good to go now for a while.
Well, speaking of good to go, I know there were 68 comments and maybe more coming, but did anybody bring up about doing genotyping like we're doing for clopidogrel response or platelet testing?
You know, that's a good point.
I didn't read
all 68
carefully
of them, and no one mentioned that. So maybe you and I should get on there.
When ABC News called that day when Clinton was hospitalized, I said one of the things for sure I would do is to make sure that he was responsive to clopidogrel.
Yeah.
He could wind up coming back with a stent thrombosis, and that wouldn't go over too well. Yeah.
So we do this on every patient. We do both the genotyping and we do Plavix or clopidogrel responsiveness. And it's really been quite, as you know, it's a bit of an adventure because this personalized medicine is very individualized for each patient. And rounds take longer now because you have patients with different responsiveness to clopidogrel and you have to decide what to do about them. I actually feel very uncomfortable discharging a patient from the hospital who has not had the platelet responsiveness done, and we always get the genotyping as well. So I know Columbia pretty well. So at Columbia, they check everybody. Everyone gets checked the next day. You know what the most interesting part is? If you can change them to prasugrel, So if they qualify for prasugrel, so they're not responsive to clopidogrel. And then if you can change into prasugrel, that's not usually too much of a problem, assuming that they're not over 80, they've never had a stroke, and their body weight is reasonable. But if you want to put them on a double dose of clopidogrel, it's often very problematic because their insurance often doesn't cover it.
Right, right. No, that's
a really
key practical
point. And I find myself sending patients to Canada. I sent them to Canada to get drugs because it's so expensive here. Do you think President Clinton needed the double dose of clopidogrel that his insurance would cover it?
Good point, Paul. Very good point. Now, let's switch over to our other celebrity political former leader, Cheney. This case I'm very familiar with in the times when he was having his infarct during the Florida recount.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved then. And, you know, the question was if he were Bush and Cheney were elected, would Cheney possibly make it through the first 4 years, no less the next 4 years?
Yeah.
And obviously he made it through those 8 years, and now he's, you know, still going strong.
He's been doing great.
But do you remember the fact that with George Washington, when they had the press conference, they said he didn't really have an infarct? And there was a definition of what an infarct was, and then he has enzymes, did indeed show myocardial damage. It was a real big flap about it. It was even a New York Times editorial about what is a heart attack. But at any rate, he's a strong fella, and, you know, just evidenced by, I don't know if it's still the case, but he's the only one I ever knew that had his own personal butcher. You know, personal trainers, but he had a personal butcher. Now, I don't know if he's still practicing that.
Just the trim to fat off the meat.
Red meat ingestion. And I don't know if that's had anything to do with his recent short hospitalization. And I guess he did reportedly have an angiogram, but he was only in overnight, and I guess he's doing well. But he did have a fifth infarct with this.
Yep.
And people are worried, how could you have five heart attacks? Any comments about that?
Well, you can have five heart attacks very easily, as you know.
Right,
you can have a troponin elevation. Every time there's a troponin elevation nowadays, it's called a heart attack. And it is a heart attack. I think it's just a degree. Well, I'm in California here, so I use the Richter scale to explain it to you. I say, well, if you want to call it a heart attack, you can. But if it was an earthquake, it would be a 2 on the Richter scale.
We know he has fairly diffuse coronary disease, and these little small infarctions, I mean, it's not a good thing. And he does have an ICD, but supposedly, at least as of perhaps a year or so ago, it had never fired. I don't know.
So if he had a small infarction, and again, we don't know his anatomy, but if he had a small infarction and he's had some stents and he's had bypass surgery, then you could imagine that he probably has either small vessel disease or maybe one of his bypass grafts closed. Again, I have no direct knowledge, but it could be that a bypass graft closed and his underlying native vessel is closed. Maybe it's his right coronary, and then you look at it and say, well, gee, you don't want to open up the closed bypass because it's going to end up with distal embolization, and there's no need to try to open his totally occluded right coronary because it'll be too big a procedure. So that's very typical. That would be one explanation. Another would be that it's diffuse disease and it's distal disease. The main thing we want there is, of course, secondary prevention. And that's, you know,
does that include pomegranate juice? Or?
Apparently, that's for nephrotoxicosis. I mean, it's NO agonist. So I learned a lot from that discussion on heart.org there. I mean, the problem, of course, is that very few of the comments are really vetted, and there's not a lot of evidence base for them, although a lot of the contributors did add some references. So you could probably spend 5 hours and probably learn a lot from reading all the comments back and forth.
I mean, I guess the good thing is there isn't really medicine by the committee of 30 people that weighed in on all
God.
That, because that would be pretty darn confusing.
The things that they recommend, the glucose tolerance test, apparently that was the most important thing that was recommended. That was the most common thing recommended. So you could imagine what would happen if medicine was a democracy. Luckily,
yeah, real good thing. Well, I mean, I think your point earlier that we do learn a lot from people in the spotlight, and particularly when they have coronary disease. And, you know, I think what's interesting here is you got two very well-known individuals who have had essentially now multi-year, or if not multi-decade, in the case of Cheney, history of coronary disease, and they're both doing quite well.
Fine,
and
yeah.
They both have, you know, very brief hospitalizations for what appeared to be either unstable angina or, in the case of Cheney, a small infarct. And in some ways, they reflect cardiology in 2010, and that's pretty good management of these folks.
That's how I'll view this. That's my perspective. I think that they're getting very good care now. Of course, you could always, you know, if you really want to think about what's going on with the healthcare debate now, you could argue that one of the problems is that not everyone has the opportunity to get that kind of care.
Right.
And you can argue that if everyone did get the care, we wouldn't have any money left. So this is a challenge. How do you really reform healthcare and yet maintain the technology, the really amazing technology that we have for patients today. It costs a lot of money, and I really don't see an easy way out. I think medicine's a good thing to spend money on. I think these are good outcomes.
These are two good examples, and
yeah.
I guess on the heart.org site, it was just so much about, as you said, secondary prevention. And there's still a lot of work to be done in that area to know what that is. In fact, what's interesting is this debate about primary prevention with aspirin and how that's even shifted to, well, you know, why give the aspirin? Because the risk in primary prevention, and it's something that we had accepted for many, many years, mm-hmm. is questionable, and more coming out on that over the weeks ahead. Well, this has been real interesting. We are at variance a little bit on when are you entitled to have a problem post-bypass. Other than that, a lot of concordance and fun to discuss it with you, Paul.
Always great.
You've been listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein on the Heart.org radio, sharing ideas and opinions with the cardiology community worldwide. Find out more on the Heart.org.